Good evening, and welcome to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. It's graduation time again across the country, with colleges and universities holding their commencement exercises, including Boston University earlier today. In honor of all the hard work leading up to this important milestone in a young person's life, we thought we'd share with you some of that work. Specifically, stories written and produced by students from this semester's narrative radio journalism class in the College of Communication here at Boston University. The students were given the following assignment: produce a story exploring the theme of good intentions. As you might expect, the topics varied widely. We begin with this report from Kasia Patel on researchers studying animals as they try to answer the question, why do people do good deeds?
This is Don Quixote and Dulcinea, appropriately named after the fictitious characters because of their strong bond. They are inseparable.
Inside voices, children.
Dulcinea and Don are mixed breeds. Dulcinea is a small, white mixed terrier weighing no more than about 15 or so pounds. Don is slightly larger with a brown fur coat and has the face of a boxer. Both dogs could easily be overlooked in a big room. What you can't see, that Don Quixote helped save her life. Owner Dolores Soteris describes how Don Quixote was there when Dulcinea needed him the most.
Dulcie and Don met each other in Puerto Rico. They were both what they call sato dogs. In Puerto Rico, it's a street dog. And they started running together, and they became bonded. And one day he went to cross the street, and she wasn't quite fast enough, and she got hit by a car. She was completely injured. She was in agony. She was screaming. And he stayed with her. In fact, he laid in the middle of the street to save her. When she came to, he guided her into a yard, and he stayed with her. He brought her food. He licked her wound and kept it from getting infected.
When the dogs were taken to the vet said if it wasn't for Don, the leg would have been so infected, the amputation would have been messy. Veterinarian Stephanie Bornsweil has been taking care of animals for 30 years and says this caring behavior isn't so unusual in social animals that travel in a pack or herd.
I think in some ways they do what they're programmed to do, and social animals have social bonds. And because of that wonderful capacity, they do these caring things.
Dr. Bornsweil is currently studying animal behavior at the Cummings Veterinary School at Tufts University. She says animals just do what's in their nature.
It's unlikely to find, say, my ball python doing something or caring for another critter because it's a solitary animal.
But not all animals, even social animals like dogs, are so nice. Peggy Fusillo, a volunteer at the Northeast Animal Shelter in Salem, Massachusetts, remembers a dog she adopted that wasn't so well behaved.
It started chasing the cat, and not in a friendly way, and I said, get down, and it nipped me.
So what gives? Pete Buston, a biology professor at Boston University, researches animal behavior. He says animals' actions, whether they seem good or bad, are actually influenced by the same factor.
Generally, we think of animals or any organisms doing things that best serve their selfish interests. Probably best to think about it is, does doing something that appears to have a good intention serve the animal well, or does something that has a bad intention serve the animal well?
In other words, a dog's bark or bite might seem nasty to us, but to the dog, it's an act of self-defense, and in many cases, triggered to protect the human who cares for them. Another possibility, says Pete Buston, is that animals have some kind of reciprocal altruism or reciprocal cooperation.
One dog may help the other sort of on the expectation of getting some help back in the future.
For Dulcinea and Don Quixote, the Puerto Rican dogs at the shelter, they each receive something from the other: companionship.
They will lay there for hours and groom each other around the ears and around the muzzle and each other, their legs. They're very, very fastidious, as my grandmother used to say, about taking care of each other.
So, according to our Boston University biologist, Pete Buston, No animal does anything for the sake of being nice, or the sake of being mean, without expecting something. And neither do humans.
I think the underlying mechanisms for humans are animals, I think it's exactly the same. And so I don't think animals or humans do anything for the greater good without an incentive, unless they're getting something out of it. Generally, I just don't think that happens very much.
It may seem disheartening to say that people only do nice things if we have incentives, but it's not as bad as it sounds.
When I talk about incentives in animals, it's things that influence the survival and reproduction of the animals. In humans, we often use financial incentives, but we can also use as incentives things that influence our quality of life, so our health and things like that.
But what if there is no personal reward? Helping the old lady across the street. Am I doing this because I expect someone to do it for me someday? Modeling good behavior now to help me later? Or am I just doing it for that feeling of satisfaction? Every once in a while, you come across extremely caring humans, or animals, like Dulcinea and Don Quixote, who do it for friendship, love, and companionship.
That's student reporter Kasia Patel. This is Boston University's World of Ideas, and tonight we're featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's narrative radio journalism class in the College of Communication. I'm Deborah Becker. Next up, Jack O'Dea reports on a new venture by a well-known restaurant chain.
From big shot executives to students shouting in from universities to the homeless, you'll find a wide variety of people at the Panera Cares Bakery and Government Center. It's a non-profit arm of the well-known restaurant chain. The cafe is situated opposite a veteran shelter and about 30 seconds away from government buildings. It seems like any of the other 1,600 Panera stores nationwide. It has the same yellow-tinted walls, the pine oak seating, and the reassuring staff. However, there is one difference. In this Panera, you won't find any registers or priceless, just suggested donations. It's Brandy Thompson's job to collect those donations.
They're trying to offer a square meal to everybody with dignity, whether they have the means or not to pay. So there's three ways you can come in. You can pay your fair share, you can give more, you can volunteer for an hour, or we can just give you a meal if you don't have the money.
This store is called Panera Cares. It is the first of its kind in the Northeast and the chain's fifth nonprofit store in the United States. Panera executives say the venture is a test in human nature. Chris Lindsay is the manager of Panera Cares in Boston.
It really definitely is a test. For the most part, people really want to help out and do what they can. It's up to us to educate them, because they might walk in and not be aware of exactly what goes on here. But when we explain it to them and they understand the concept and the mission, they want to help out, especially because it's their own community.
While some patrons eat for free, others choose to pay more than they would at a normal Panera. To save on costs and expenses, pastries and bread are brought in from other Panera stores. Diners give it mixed reviews.
They need a little bit more tender care with their food. My friend and I were discussing how we've never got our food so fast at Panera, like we're used to waiting, and then we got our food, and it wasn't, like, it's still good, but it just wasn't the same.
Some customers, like Kaisha, say the staff needs to better explain how the Panera Cares payment system works.
I think they have a long way to go in terms of educating the consumer, because I had no idea what she was talking about. I was confused. I was really confused when I came in. I just found it odd. She rattled some stuff off really quickly, and I gave her my money, and then she was like, well, do you want me to break it? I was confused.
Customers like George are appreciative. George is homeless.
It's helpful for people that can't afford a real meal, a regular, you know what I mean? I think it's a good thing. Because I'm pretty poor, I'm homeless, so I mean, I don't have any way of getting money. I don't have a job or anything, so it's helpful for me, and I think for a lot of other people in my position.
George is not the only homeless customer. But Marissa Zidane, who greets the customers, says all sorts of people are becoming regular customers.
We have a balance that I think is similar to the other cafes, where there's like 60% are the people who can give that suggested value, and then you've got like 10 to 20% who give above and significantly less. And that sounds about right for what I see. People who come in and just tell me, oh, I'm coming from the shelter.
Then there are the customers, Marissa says, who take advantage of the concept.
It's this very odd and tricky situation where you know that you have to be accepting whatever it is that people are willing to give. And yet at the same time, being able to recognize when somebody is very clearly trying to take us down or they think it's funny to kind of pull one over and be able to address it in a way that lets them know that, hey, actually, you're taking something away from somebody who's in need.
But is this a sustainable model? Again, manager Chris Lindsay.
As far as future development, I don't really get involved in that, but I do know it depends on the success of the other Panera Cares. So if we can run good operations and or do what we're supposed to do here, then they want to open them up all over.
It is uncertain whether the Panera Cares model will catch on with other businesses. But with an estimated 1 out of 6 Americans unable to get the food they need each day, Panera says it is doing what it can to help.
That story filed by student reporter Jack O'Dea. Up next, Tammy Kim reports on Project Mailbox.
Do you know what this mailbox is?
No, what is it?
I'm just dropping off some of my change from Starbucks.
That's Nicole Merritt. She's a junior at Boss University, majoring in public relations, and is very passionate about community service. For someone like Merritt, who is always tied up with her academics and involvement in her sorority, student government, and campus affairs, making a small donation to Project Mailbox every once in a while is an easy way to try to make a difference. The story behind the mailbox begins a year ago with Nick Daugherty, a recent BU graduate. He launched Project Mailbox to remind everyone that a little spare change can go a long way. Daugherty says the mailbox concept was inspired by an old tale he once heard.
When a family fell on hard times, it wasn't that you'd reach out to the government or you'd reach out to any higher organization. Your community around you would just know that you're going through this tough time, and they'd put change in your mailbox knowing that if they were to fall on a similarly tough time, that you would be there for them.
The goal of Project Mailbox is to encourage people to make a difference by dropping their spare change into the box. Daugherty says there is power in numbers, and the more people give, the more the organization has to distribute to worthy causes. In some ways, it is a charity for other charities.
That's really the message I want to get out there, is that if you give, you're going to get in return, and I want people to get in the habit of giving so that they can make the world a better place. And it really starts with just a small donation and just getting involved in that small way.
Engineers Without Borders is just one of several organizations that has been awarded a check from Project Mailbox. At the end of every month, students meet to nominate and vote on which charitable organization will be given the spare change.
It's based on college campuses, so students are extremely busy in their everyday lives. What Project Mailbox does is it really reduces the barriers to entry into getting involved with philanthropy. From donating just a dime or a nickel or a quarter a month, you can be part of something larger than yourself.
Rather than being persuaded to donate through aggressive canvassers on the streets, people can give to the community by lightening the load in their pockets and purses. The proceeds don't amount to much. Project Mailbox has collected and donated anywhere from $204 in October 2012 for communities and schools of Greater New Orleans to around $518 for the Supply Education Group in April 2012. No matter what the amount, Daugherty says the act of giving is what really counts.
Really, the numbers that stick out to me isn't necessarily the dollar amount, but the number of coins that we see in the box. Because 200 pennies is 200 pennies. That could be 200 people donating, but it's only $2 that we're raising. So for us, it's more about the participation than anything. So the numbers far outweigh sort of the dollar values, and that's what's really exciting for me.
A few hundred dollars may not change the world, but Daugherty says it's a start. According to Daugherty, if every student at BU contributed only one quarter every week to Project Mailbox, the BU community would be able to donate $4,000 to a charity every month. As a relatively new organization, Project Mailbox is hoping to see growth in numbers, both in participants and in coins. To achieve these goals, Daugherty is currently working on expanding the movement beyond BU's campus.
it's one of those things where we'd like to be in the thousands every month, but we're in the hundreds, and that's okay. I mean, it's hundreds of dollars that these charities wouldn't have had otherwise. We'd love to have more mailboxes throughout the campus so that they can raise more money. And that's basically our big goal of Project Mailbox, is to show college students that it's not hard to be involved in charity, and it's not hard to be a lifelong philanthropist.
Daugherty and the Project Mailbox team are expanding the mission to other campuses, including Boston College and Northeastern University.
That's student reporter Tammy Kim. This is WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. You're listening to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's narrative radio journalism class in the College of Communication. Tonight's theme is Good Intentions. Next, student Melanie Morse reports on serving in the Peace Corps in Africa.
When we arrived, we were taken to the Peace Corps house in Tana, which is the capital, or Antananarivo, and we learned how to squat over a pot in our bedroom that was going to be our toilet.
Annie Kashko is a University of Washington graduate with a nursing degree. She went to Madagascar as a Peace Corps volunteer in September 2006.
This is a song that I've loved for a long time. When we were in training and we were about to finish up training and go to our sites, our Peace Corps trainers sang this song, and it was so beautiful. I kind of started crying, I think, a little bit.
Kashko's mission was to develop maternal and child health programs in a poor country.
Then we were taken to our host families and dropped off with about five different words that we knew in Malagasy.
Those words were hello, goodbye, and where do I find the bathroom? Kashko was assigned to a small village just south of NCR Bay, one of the larger cities in Madagascar.
They drop you off, and then you begin your journey. And when I saw the Peace Corps car driving away, I was like, oh my gosh, what did I just sign myself up for?
It turned out to be the best experience of her life.
My primary assignment was to do health education at our local health center. 3 days a week, they would do, for example, prenatal care visits, family planning, and then child vaccines and child wellness days. So for those days, I would go to the clinic and do my health education to a group of about 30 to 40 women, talking, you know, about various health subjects.
Even though she's a nurse, Annie Kashko could not provide skilled nursing care, since a Peace Corps cannot be held liable. However, as time went on, she took on other projects. She had really hoped to bring electricity and running water to the clinic where she worked. She raised money from family and friends back home to buy solar panels.
We got them installed, but they weren't working correctly. And, well, what I eventually found out right before I left the country was that when I went to pay the gentleman who was responsible for installing the solar panels, after I'd given him the money and left, the doctor and the mayor of my village, they had actually said, hey, we got you this job, so now we need a cut of the money. And they ended up taking probably half of the funds that I had raised for the solar panels.
Kashko says payoffs and petty corruption are a routine part of the scenery. She suspects the installer ran out of money to finish the job, which is why the electricity never came on. She ended up donating the solar panels to another nonprofit so they would not be sold.
I felt awful that I'd lost the money for the people who had so generously donated to the project, and then I felt devastated that I couldn't actually bring electricity to the clinic. At night, women have to deliver by candlelight, which, as you can probably think, is not very safe.
While the Peace Corps volunteers and local residents could not get the electricity going, after lots of work, there was running water to the clinic. And Kashko ended up with another surprise. She met her future husband. His name is Fetra, a local Malagasy who worked for an NGO. The couple started a nonprofit to educate young girls.
Our nonprofit is called Project Vevavi Matanzaka. We can just call it PVM. Vevavi Matanzaka means powerful woman in Malagasy.
Kashko's husband believes educating women is important for development of the country.
PVM is like small organization, but we really, really focusing on those two girls right now. We want them to go in a better school, the best school, so they can, like, reach their goal for their life.
Kashko and her husband were married in Seattle in 2009. They now live in Boston. They returned to Madagascar last year and got the surprise of their lives.
Funny enough, we come back this summer and we see the gentleman that we donated the solar panels to. And he said, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe you're here. I can't believe I saw you, but we have the solar panels. They're on a clinic that's about 30 kilometers south of my village, and they're working. And they use them in the maternity ward." And we were so overjoyed to be able to know that what we wanted to have come out of the project, it actually happened. It might not have been our village, my village that I was in, but it was in a village somewhere, so it was bringing electricity to help mothers give birth.
And Annie Kashko hopes to return to Africa. Even if it's slow going, she says someone has to help people out of the cycle of poverty.
Student Melanie Morris filed that report. This is WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker with a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas. We're featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's narrative radio journalism class in the College of Communication. The theme of tonight's stories is good intentions. Next, student reporter Noel Graves introduces us to a man who gave up his 30-year career to help people in the jungles of Nicaragua.
All right, we've got a mosquito repellent here, have food, a little emergency medical kit, medicines as well, all set. Now, can I get all these in this bag? That is the question.
Roger Drost is stooped over a backpack in the living room of his Ipswich home. The backpack is way past whatever its capacity is. But Drost is looking at it, determined, like someone trying to figure out how to cram that last piece of luggage in the overloaded car.
It's always a challenge to get everything in the bag. Normally we pack up a lot of things for folks in the village, so it's always how much can we squeeze in.
The folks in the village are the people of the Mosquito Coast, which is on the east coast of Nicaragua. Nicaragua is the second poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, and the Mosquito Coast is a jungle where most villagers live in huts and farm rice and plantains by hand.
It's typical for a farmer to leave his house, little hut in the morning, very early, head out into a swamp or a marsh in the jungle or in the rainforest with a machete in hand and clear his land, plant rice, perhaps water up, you know, halfway up to his knees in his bare feet, then trying to nurture those fields and protect it from predators and from poachers. Life is a real struggle for survival.
Floods and hurricanes are common on the Mosquito Coast. Food is sometimes hard to come by here. There's not much medical care. Malaria and dengue fever are common. Drost first found his way to the coast in 1998.
I joined a missions trip from my church and just fell in love with the place, had a real sense of belonging in the community. I felt my heart tugged to do more work there and not to just make it a one-shot deal.
Drost, who is married with grown children, continued to visit Nicaragua every year for more than a decade. Then, 2 years ago, he decided to make a life change. He left his teaching job of 30 years to become U.S. field director for a humanitarian organization that serves Nicaragua's poor. The Massachusetts-based Peace and Hope Trust is funded with donations. Drost and the other Peace and Hope Trust workers are motivated by more than just their desire to help. They see their work as a way to follow the example and teachings of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I became a Christian when I was in high school. Someone told me something that was unbelievable to me, which is that the Christian faith is not about religion or following rules, but it is about having a relationship with someone named Jesus Christ. And that was quite remarkable to me, and it drew me. And that was really the beginning of sort of my walk of faith.
Drost and his colleagues serve people in lots of simple ways. They give out mosquito nets, build rice mills, radio outposts. They dig wells and give food, clothing, and medicine to the villagers after hurricanes and floods. Drost has also spent time with the churches that are already on the Mosquito Coast.
One evening, I was, after a day of hard work with a team, I was surprised to hear music drifting out of a dark corner of the village back toward the jungle canopy. And it seemed to have a very joyous tone to it. It was quite uplifting, and I recognized some mosquito music and some melodies that I've heard sung in churches.
Dross grabbed a flashlight and walked into the darkness, through a muddy clearing, to find a group of mosquito villagers with guitars sitting under the stars, singing Christian praise songs in the mosquito language.
They saw me, I had my flashlight, and they said, oh, come over, take a seat, and listen to us. And I felt that I needed to record this and share with some other people just the beauty of both their worship and the beauty of their language as they sung.
In recent years, things haven't been so beautiful. The problem of poverty has been compounded by drug trafficking up and down the Mosquito Coast. Sometimes cocaine washes up on the shores of these remote villages, probably thrown overboard during skirmishes with police.
We began to see the impact on villagers we knew. One young person comes to mind who was drawn into drug trafficking and himself became an addict, took a pretty steep fall into just begging on the street and homelessness. We've seen the effects over the years.
Peace and Hope Trust is now working on plans for a halfway house for cocaine addicts up in the mountains of central Nicaragua, away from the coast and its drug trade.
It can be discouraging, but I guess the positive part of it is that we recognize it as something perhaps we can help with, that perhaps we can provide some vehicle for these folks to be able to overcome some of the addiction and get their lives moving in the right direction.
Drost accepts change comes one person at a time, one village at a time. Still, it is happening. The rice mills are providing regular income. A new storm shelter saved villagers from hurricane floodwaters. And radio outposts are keeping isolated villages in touch with each other. Drost says he is thrilled and blessed to be a part of it.
Hallelujah! Hallelujah!
Student reporter Noelle Graves. Now, here's student reporter Sasha Gary.
Here is the church. Here is the steeple. Open the door and... where are all the people?
It's Sunday morning in Jamaica Plain. The Hope Central Pentecostal Church is in session as it is every Sunday. Besides a few elderly worshipers, there is hardly anyone in attendance today.
What are you up to today?
I'm about to go to yoga in back there.
It's Sunday today. Why are you at church?
I'm not really religious, I guess. I'm more spiritual, so I don't really go to church.
Where are you going? Why aren't you at church?
Oh, I'm going to work. I don't go to church.
You never go to church?
No, it's not really my thing.
Well, recent Pew statistics show that the proportion of Americans who are unaffiliated with any church has increased to 16%. Churches, for some, are synonymous with benevolence. And this trend could have serious implications for society's motivation to act selflessly. Of the unaffiliated, 5% of Americans identify as atheist, which reflects a five-fold increase over the past 5 years. Atheists are among the most distrusted groups in America, according to Gallup data. They can be subject to the view that without God, they are motivated to please only themselves. The Boston Atheists, the largest atheist membership organization in New England, disagree with this view. While it is a group bound together by members' non-belief, the club is active in philanthropic work. Their interim president, Josiah Van Vliet, explains what makes atheists do good without God.
People want to do good because we're wired to do good. The atheists, I think, are good people because they're good human beings. And that's a question of biology and psychology, not of theology.
Josiah blames an increasingly commercialized American society for making doing good a challenge for some. He thinks that it is human nature to act altruistically, but that society members, like the constituents in his organization, need to be given the chance to act in this way.
If you take a basically healthy human being and put them in a basically healthy environment, they will behave basically ethically. It takes real pathology for someone to be a bad person.
Dr. Wesley Wildman is a professor of religion, ethics, and philosophy at the Boston University School of Theology. He agrees that human beings are biologically wired to be good, but he also sees a need for religion.
Religion can actually be very, very helpful in binding people together. Mm-hmm. If you want to run a large, complicated civilization where you have to trade with people from God knows where, and where you have to get along with people with different personalities and different economic incentives or interests than you've got, it's going to be complicated. And religion can bind people together in a particularly powerful way that doesn't seem to be possible just using the evolutionarily stabilized tendencies to altruism.
Dr. Wildman believes that religion can create a kind of accountability and structure that helps with people's good intentions.
What religion adds to it is something like the Santa Claus effect. He knows when you've been naughty, he knows when you've been nice. The idea that there's some kind of being watching over you. So religion, something like an additional power source to strengthen cooperation and the sorts of positive moral virtues you want in a society.
Dr. Wildman thinks that the sense of commonality that religion brings to groups of people is what many non-believers feel they lack.
When I talk to atheists, I often encounter a feeling of frustration that they don't have the same kind of strong communities, so that when they get sick, people bring them meals and they go through all the stages of life together in a community. I think they miss that and they envy that in religious communities.
There are, however, a growing number of venues for the non-religious to find kinship. The Harvard Humanists is one such group. It's an organization for secular students and community members to meet and engage civically with the belief that non-believers can live a good life without God. Chris Stedman is the community organizer and assistant chaplain at the Harvard Humanists. He explains there are actually plenty of opportunities for the religiously unaffiliated to find community today.
There are people who find personally fulfilling community exclusively through the internet. There are people who find it in, you know, intentional living communities or by joining a knitting club.
Stedman thinks that these social outlets provide an important opportunity for uniting people who are not interested in church communities. He has some reservations about their usefulness when it comes to generating conversations that bolster the good intentions of their members, as religious institutions traditionally have.
I think that being a part of a community that talks about what it means to live a good life, what it means to be a person who contributes to the lives of others, I mean, I think that that kind of community is still very important. And I wonder where people are thinking about those things and where they're engaging in conversations about those things when not in those communities.
Stedman says that community is one of the best ways to learn from one another. He thinks that this is a promising path to a just secular society, and that even without God, we can move from a culture of me to a culture of we.
Student reporter Sasha Gary. Here's Kirsten Eggenhofer with a story about a weekly peace vigil in Western Massachusetts.
At noon, Mark Watkins unpacks his signs next to South Pleasant Street in Amherst.
My sign says, "Send your money, send your kids, billionaires for war."
He picks a spot on the sidewalk next to Town Common, a grassy patch at a bustling intersection, and faces the cars stopped at the traffic lights.
You don't have to be a monk. You don't have to be silent. You don't have to be, you know, somebody who never gets angry. You know, I think a little anger is constructive and useful sometimes.
Within a few minutes, 8 or 9 people join Watkins with their own handmade signs and banners. This is the Amherst Peace Vigil, or...
The technical name is the Amherst Vigil for Peace and Justice in a Nuclear-Free World. That kind of gives you a sense of how long ago it was started, when those were, you know, the urgent issues of the day. And they still are, but now we have slightly different issues to contend with.
Every Sunday since 1979, from noon to 1, you can find people standing on this spot. Early on, there may have been a couple of weeks when no one showed up, but Pat Church cannot remember a time without the vigil.
We're here in the rain. We're here in the cold, and we're here in the heat.
Church comes here every Sunday. For her, the vigil is a vital part of this community.
We are a place where people know there is vigil. You know, it's a presence. And for some of us, you know, it's different, I'm sure, for other people. But for me, it's my, like, church or whatever.
But when it comes to the big question, is this vigil actually making a difference? Even loyal supporters like Church are not so sure.
Are we going to shut down war? Probably not.
Most of the people at the peace vigil are over 60. This is far from their first anti-war protest. After a lifetime of doing this sort of thing, you might wonder why they still show up. But everyone here has a story to tell about someone they met. Some young people stop by to talk about a personal dilemma. Should they join the military? Another man is amazed that the peace vigil is still here. He used to come here every week as a kid. One day, a college student comes by and completely out of the blue says that he changed his major because he saw the peace activists standing on this street corner. They only talk briefly, but to Pat Church, these conversations represent a real way to make some kind of difference.
Individual by individual is the only way you accomplish change. You can't legislate it. You have to have it grow from relationships. And if our brief relationships with people cause them to make different choices, then, you know, we've won.
These folks are not sentimental old hippies. They are resilient. And for all their talk about peace and love, they clearly thrive on conflict.
I'm not a pacifist. If you hit me with that microphone, I'll try to stop you.
Stan Marin chuckles as he watches one of the demonstrators jog after a honking car to see whether the young driver is flashing them a peace sign or flipping the bird.
Everybody doesn't love us. See?
When their hour is up, these activists pack up their signs and head home. But they'll be back. Their mission is not over. They'll stand here again, trying to win over some hearts and minds each Sunday from noon to one.
Student reporter Kirsten Eggenhofer. This is WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. You're listening to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas. We're featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's narrative radio journalism class in the College of Communication. Tonight's theme is Good Intentions. Now here's Ponce Rutsch with a report on a job that's all about good intentions.
Every week, about 10 students spend 8 hours a day learning lifeguarding in an intensive course at the Boston University pool.
My name is Katie Magali. I'm from Newton, Massachusetts. I'm 15. I wanted to become a lifeguard because my sister did, and I really like swimming, and I wanted a summer job.
There's a lot more to lifeguarding than sunshine and swimming.
Ready, set, one, two, three.
That's the sound of students learning CPR. Each student is on their knees next to a school mannequin, arms centered under their shoulders for strong chest compressions. The clicking sound means the lifeguard trainees are pushing hard enough to pump the victim's heart. They count to 30, and then they switch to rescue breaths.
30, two breaths, finish your cycle.
It's like scary in the process of like actually doing what you're supposed to and like doing it correctly at the time you need to. Because you can do it in class, but like when it comes down to it, you need to be able to do it during the actual emergency.
That's Katie Magali again. The students recognize their responsibility as lifeguards.
My name's Robin Farrell. I hope my first day I wouldn't have to dive in and make a rescue, but if it comes to it, gotta do it.
But here's the catch. CPR is only successful about 10% of the time. Add in other factors like the patient's health, medications, a defibrillator, and CPR could be 30% successful, but 10 is the average.
Go, go, go. Look down,
even though the 10% statistic isn't one that many people know, the Red Cross is straightforward about this. Here's instructor Amy Woogmaster, reading from the lifeguard manual.
Despite your best efforts to provide quality care, not all victims of cardiac arrest survive. That is a fact of life. Something is so seriously wrong that this person needs CPR, even with the best CPR, the best drugs, the best shot, the best care, best hospital, I mean, people do not always make it.
Wigmaster makes sure to stress this fact in class. She doesn't want her students to blame themselves if CPR doesn't work out someday. She has worked as an EMT, meaning that she's trained to work on ambulances and as a first responder in an emergency. One of her toughest experiences was administering CPR to a 19-year-old girl who had a seizure.
It's your adrenaline kicks in and you just deal with it like it's some project that has to get done. You kind of have to take the human aspect out of it to know that you're doing what you need to do. And then afterwards, you think about the fact that, like, okay, I did this and this was a person and it was somebody's parent or child. And then it hits you.
Wigmaster and her colleagues didn't revive this girl, but she was stable. She had a heartbeat and was breathing and started to recover in the hospital. A week later, Wigmaster learned that the girl had died. She told this story in class.
So we did save her then, and she was okay for a week, and then whatever was wrong, sent her back into cardiac arrest. We were, like, so excited, it was so successful, it was great, and then, like, never mind.
Wigmaster sounds all business when she talks about something so emotional. But there's a reason for that.
I've given CPR a number of times, some successful, some not, and that definitely resonates with you. And if you let it sink into you, you'll never move on. So you kind of have to put your emotions aside and say that you did the best you can and you did all that you could. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't, it was beyond you.
Fortunately, most of lifeguarding is about surveying the pool and making sure that nothing goes awry. Rescues are pretty rare. And Wigmaster is sure to remind her students that if they're cautious, they may never even have to use CPR.
I could count on one hand the number of lifeguards I know that have had to do CPR.
But when duty calls, these lifeguards will be ready. Here's Nora Cameron, another student.
I know that it's not necessarily going to bring the person back to life. It's just going to keep them stable until, like, EMS gets there. I feel like even though it's 10%, that 10% matters. Because, like, it's still going to help in some situations, so it's good to know.
Even though CPR isn't as effective as it is on TV, lifeguards will still do everything they can to keep swimmers safe.
Student reporter Ponce Rutsch. In our final story tonight, student reporter Taylor Avery tells us the story of one person trying to make her life more meaningful.
You see, George, you really had a wonderful life.
Just like James Stewart's character, George Bailey, in It's a Wonderful Life, many middle-aged adults feel unfulfilled for failing to realize their dreams. But 41-year-old Donna Cotterell of the Mission Hill neighborhood in Boston is doing something about it.
I can use theater not only to help me, but to help others.
Cotterell says she got the theater bug when she was about 14 years old.
It just fell into my lap. I was in ninth grade, and there was a theater class that we could take over the summer at one of the local community schools. And so I took this theater class over the summer, and after taking that summer course, I really liked it. And I asked my parents, could I continue in their regular classes on Saturday mornings? And thank God they had the money to send me. And I started taking acting classes, and I was doing improvisational theater from then on.
For Cotterell, theater is not only fun, but also therapeutic. She grew up with an alcoholic and sometimes violent father.
Loved my dad, thought the world of him, still do, but I could have let that limit me in my options. I look at some of my family members who are still stuck in that cycle of trauma that gets handed down from generation to generation. But I saw how theater helped me overcome that obstacle in my life.
But it wasn't always like that. Cotterell has spent most of her adult life either as a middle school math teacher or working towards her master's degree in education at Lesley University. She did not discover drama therapy as her formalized niche until fairly recently.
I stumbled on drama therapy probably about 4 or 5 years ago. And I was already going through the Lesley program for my middle school master's degree. I had finished my master's in BU, and I said, I don't want to do a third master's.
Cotterell realized that if she wanted her dream to become a reality, she would have to start from scratch and get that degree.
I've taken 3 courses so far. Now I'm about to sign up for the program, and I'm embarking on this journey. I don't know how long it's going to take or where it's going to take me.
Cotterell was able to find the path to fulfilling her lifelong dream. But psychology professor Catherine Caldwell-Harris of Boston University says many others don't and are left disappointed.
Humans need to find a way to rise in the social hierarchy of their group and to maintain friends and have alliances and to guard against people who might try to malign or ostracize them. And so how do we feel secure in our group? It's all about achieving goals.
Harris says it's never too late to change course.
I would urge people to try to take the steps to change and find the career or other type of fulfillment that they want. And one way to do that is to find other people who also want to change and bond together with those other people. Seek help for change.
For many people, switching gears can be difficult. But Harris says they don't have to be unhappy.
If you decide that change is going to be too hard, then the route to go would be to try to become satisfied with what one has and focus on the good things such as one's family or friends or the non-work-related items in one's life.
A lesson that George Bailey eventually learned in It's a Wonderful Life.
Good idea, Ernie. A toast to my big brother George, the richest man in town.
Student reporter Taylor Avery. That concludes tonight's special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's narrative radio journalism class in the College of Communication. Our student contributors were, in order of appearance, Kasha Patel, Jack O'Dea, Tammy Kim, Melanie Morris, Noelle Graves, Sasha Gary, Kirsten Eggenhofer, Ponce Rutsch, and Taylor Avery. Thanks to Boston University Associate Professor Ann Donahue, who helped edit their stories. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mark Degon and Michael Garth, with help from Mike Toda and Tim Skog. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Congratulations to all of today's graduates, and thanks for joining us. We'll